The opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host and guest and are not necessarily those of WSTU. WSTU does not endorse products that may be mentioned. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited without written consent of WSTU. It's time now for A Priest and a Rabbi. Call in with your questions, 220-9788, 220-WSTU. Now, here's your host.
And the views and opinions expressed do not reflect the views of St. Mary's Episcopal Church and Temple Beit Hayam. Now, here's your hosts, Rabbi Durbin and Father Christian.
Good morning, Stuart, Florida. It is your two favorite clergy members. Maybe not, but right now it is. It's Father Christian and Rabbi Durbin here to give you your dose of just some. What do we want to call this, Rabbi Durbin?
I think we started with the whole notion. It's kind of a working title, I think, right? We started with the notion of a priest, a rabbi, and we just happened to stumble into a radio show.
And so that is the working title.
That's
right,
the working title.
A priest and a rabbi walk into a radio station.
Yeah.
All right. We would love to have some other ideas out there. So if you all out there, anyone listening, if you're here, just give us a shout, because we need some ideas. But maybe you got to listen to the show for a little bit to figure out what exactly we're doing here. So let's get to that.
So what is that? What is this about? What is this whole radio show between two, what I would say, amazing and just very dynamic clergy? What's it about?
Well, I think you and I talked about your hope at the end of this is that I convert to Judaism, and my hope is that you convert to Christianity. So it's sort of just like a religious grudge match on the radio for everyone to watch and see what happens.
I like the idea.
Okay, cool. Now beyond that, I think we were sitting there at lunch one day, as we do, as the, I think, the two youngest clergy members in Martin County. Just kidding. Mm-hmm. I know there's others out there. Just bad joke. And you and I had talked about this idea of, we just want to create something that can add a little bit more accessibility to the community, to engage with folks, to either talk about anything, whether it's religion, whether it's faith, but also, heck, like pop culture. Mm-hmm. And let's get these two clergy guys in a room and let's talk about what's going on with Eminem and MGK.
So I do have to say, as one who was born in Canada, we're always the generation behind. Right. So when we talk about pop culture, I may be 10 years behind you. So I'm still watching, you know, Beverly Hills 90210 to have my own, you know, understanding of what's going on here with.
Hold up. Are you watching the original season? Are you watching
the 1991?
Bro.
Yes.
Oh, Rabbi.
we're still getting there.
That's two decades behind now.
It is two decades behind.
Yeah. And fun fact, that original 90210, the mother who became, she, I think she had a cocaine addiction, mm-hmm. the character, she is now an Episcopal priest.
Oh, wow.
Stop your lying.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not everywhere, but we just trickle in from all different places.
Well, I will say, from the pop culture perspective, the fact that Ian Ziering, when he started the show, was supposed to be, you know, a 17, 18 year old student in high school, but he was casted when he was 41 years old, which is quite amazing when you think about it.
Yeah.
That, you know, he promotes himself in the show, which has that young feel to him, which was just incredible.
Okay. So true or false here, Rabbi Durbin, have you ever quoted 90210 in a sermon?
Not currently.
Are you down for the challenge?
I am down for the challenge.
Tonight, can you fit in? This is my challenge to you, brother. Can you fit in a 90210 reference into your sermon?
What I could say is just based on time, that literally in 10 hours from now, we will be doing services at 7:30 tonight for our Shabbat evening service. I don't know I can commit to certainly a 90210 reference tonight, but I could certainly commit to the next, probably for the next Shabbat. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so for next Shabbat, that's in 2 weeks. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here, that in 2 weeks, you will get a 90210 reference into your sermon at Shabbat service.
I can try and do that.
No, there's not try, bro.
No, so whether it be in the sermon or whether it be, you know, closing benediction, sure, we can look at something like that.
you can give me one too, man. I haven't fully written my sermon yet. So if when you find something that you want me to jump on,
So let's take it from the 90210 perspective, okay. Right? So if I commit to the 90210, let's have you try and commit to Melrose Place.
Can we go? I wasn't a big Melrose guy.
Oh, come on.
I'll go deep. And
go Party of Five. Go Party of Five.
Can we just go 21 Jump Street?
We could do that.
But I'm going to lose half my congregation.
It's okay.
What is Father Christian saying? 21. But the remake. Actually, there was a remake, so I might be saved by that.
Could be.
I might be saved by that. All right. So in any event, Rabbi and I said, hey, let's get this show together and make complete fools out of ourselves. We wanted to create something that was accessible, you know, here in the 21st century. Let's be real. Not everyone has darkened the door of a church or a temple. And so always, how do you get out there and find new ways to communicate? And we're not going to be sitting up here looking for conversion factors, I think, and trying to proselytize. I think it's like, hey, man, we're just two dudes mm-hmm. who are in love with God and committed to the work that we do and want to engage with the community around us, but also show that we're just two normal guys.
Mm-hmm. But I also think it was, you know, exactly as we talked about before, right, which is what is the aim of this entire program? You know, why are we here? And I think part of it for us, as we've talked about it, is, you know, to make it relevant, make it accessible.
Yeah.
You know, to let people know that, you know, we are here. I mean, our respective communities are, what, 3/4 of a mile away from one another, is to be able to say, you know, come check us out. You know, we do services Friday night at 7:30. We do Saturday morning services at 9:00. We do a tour study at 10 o'clock. You know, come see what we're about. You know, engage with us. You know, in some way, it's, you know, for our perspective at Temple Beit HaYam, we are, yes, a Jewish synagogue, but also at the same time, you know, we have tons of people who come to visit us. Come see what we Jews practice, what we believe, what we, you know, our liturgy, our music. You know, our doors are open for all who come in. And I think that that's what we had discussed, which was, you know, that whole ability for us as clergy to be able to say whatever challenge or experience you're going through, you know, we're here. We want to listen. And we want to be part through those, you know, challenging moments, those difficult times, those joyous occasions, to be able to share it with you, which is, you know, part of the reason why, you know, speak personally, why I became a rabbi, was to be able to have those sacred relationships and those sacred opportunities to kind of follow one on their journey and where they are at the given moment.
It really is a very blessed vocation where mm-hmm. in any given day, I'll be sitting in my office and I can have someone come in the morning who just literally stumbled in to the church and who's experiencing suicidal tendencies, who needed someone to talk to, who mm-hmm. felt as a child went to church, has fallen away from the church and said, you know what, I'm going to go. And I'm going to go find a priest and I'm going to talk to him about this issue I got going on. Mm-hmm. And you can be there. Like there's this understanding, hopefully, that there's this healthy understanding that you can go into a church and hopefully feel that there's not going to be judgment, that you can unveil and uncover and be vulnerable with what's going on in your life. And then after I meet with that person, which can lead to a wedding preparation with a bride and a groom. And to your point, this both the sides of life, the highs and the lows that we have in life, but we have this honor of being able to walk with people side mm-hmm. by side and guide them through it. And the church has this, I don't know any other institution that is free that you could just walk right in and say, how do I do life? How do I experience life? I need some help with this. And how does the higher power fit into all this? Mm-hmm. Do you mean to understand this, this wild experience we call life, yeah. And the church and the synagogue, in our experiences, are right there and want to walk with you and want to ask the big questions mm-hmm. and want to deal with doubt and struggle and faith. So, and especially though, because I want to get into this in this show, that we live in a Christian community. Mm-hmm. So I would love at some point, we have to go too deep. I think we can go into this like next episode. What is it like to be a Jew here in Martin County? What's it like sometimes where it's not every other person you see, you can't assume is practicing the Jewish faith. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of misunderstandings of the Jewish faith. There's still horrible stereotypes that are practiced that I hear in conversations. Mm-hmm. So I would reiterate, yes, take up Rabbi Durbin on his invitation. Just go check it out and hang out because I've been to your service. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
You learn so much and from a cultural perspective, from a faith perspective. So at the very least, hopefully the show will open those doors absolutely. As well.
And I think that that's also what we had discussed too, which was, you know, the whole ability for interfaith conversation, interfaith dialogue, you know, Jews, Christians, Muslims, we are we're together in some way. And I think, you know, from our perspective of you and I, kind of sitting down and whether it be having lunch, breaking bread, being together to be able to share a lot of our similarities, a lot of our differences, but to be able to come together, to be able to really experience that and to say, you know, interfaith dialogue can happen. It should happen. It's important for us to break those unfortunate stereotypes that we have, you know, as a rabbi and as a Jew living in Martin County or living in the United States where it is a non-Jewish world. We're not in Israel. We're not in Israel anymore. You know, so that whole notion of, you know, how do I live my life as a Jew? How do I experience the Jewish world while at the same time taking in the, you know, the local culture, the local society in which we live? And, you know, what does that mean for me? You know, as Jews, it's tough work. We have to work at it. We have to be it. We have to live it. But, you know, on that same vein. So my question to you, Father Anderson, is how? Why? How did you get into this vocation, this understanding, a little bit of background, you know, who you are, where you come from?
Yeah, I think we both are definitely chomping at the bit to know more about one another, why we chose or responded to the call, as they refer to it in the priesthood, of responding to the call. Before I did this, I mean, this is my second vocation. So before I did this, I was in the entertainment world in Los Angeles. So working as an actor, producing, and then working as a network host at some point. And the movement, a lot of people ask me, like, why did you, that's such a big jump. But for me, it doesn't, because it's still being in the entertainment world, you are telling a story. That's what you're a storyteller. And the people who tell stories the best are the ones who work. Mm-hmm. The ones who tell untruthful stories where it seems like a bunch of BS, you don't work. You don't get the gig, whether you're the writer, whether you're the actor, whether you're the director, you got to tell good, authentic stories. And so the church, you know, believes that it has the greatest story of all time, right? And so but we've done a poor job of telling that story in the last, I would say, in the last 20, 30 years. And so it wasn't that big of a jump to be like, well, this call inside of me has been happening since I was 10, feeling this call of what would it be like to be a priest? But I had no idea what that answer was. And I couldn't even figure out that answer because I never knew what a priest did between Monday and Saturday. Sundays are easy to see, but Monday through, what's the nitty gritty, dirty stuff that you got to, what does it really mean? And so over, I would say probably 20 years, I just worked on me and worked on me and worked on me to a point where finally being in front of a priest, Carol Anderson, she's one of my mentors, and just went to her and said, you know, this thing is growing, this urge to do it. And the first thing she says, don't do it. Because if you ain't all in, you're going to be miserable because this job will eat you up and spit you out if you're not fully committed to this. And then again, went back into the process. I mean, the Episcopal Church just rings you out where you have to really take your time in discerning this call to be a priest. Because I know if you are not fully all in, if you just want to be a romantic priest and just be there on Sundays and just be all flowery and say the liturgy, that's you're toast, man. You're toast. And so finally I got to a point where she's like, all right, I'm hearing it, I'm feeling it. And then you got to jump through about 20 fiery hoops. I don't know what it's like for you, but the head priest has got to recognize the call. And then after that, then you have to get a committee that works with you for 14 months. And they, after 14 months, where they grill you on finances, grill you on emotion, see if you're, make sure you're not psychotic, you got issues, because we all know there's some clergy with some issues. And then they will then, after 14 months, say, okay, yeah, we see the call. Then after that, you got to go in front of the bishop. Then the bishop's got to recognize the call. And then after that, you got to go to this crazy weekend where there's deacons and priests and lay leaders who quiz you on everything. And then after that, they got to say that they accept the call. And then after all that, then you can go to seminary. And the seminary has to also say, you know what, we support this guy and or this woman in going into the priesthood. So it's long, it's laborious, but it's good because it weeds out a lot of folks who are just – you might feel it, the call, but the whole community's got to feel the call, which I like about the denomination. It can't just be, I feel like I got a call. People would be like, yeah, you know what? I'm feeling it too. So what's the process like for you all?
So, you know, it's an interesting process. I was trained through rabbinical school through Europe. So I did 4 years in London, a year in Jerusalem, and I finished up in New York City. But the precursor, as I went into it, you know, you have to have an undergraduate degree. you must have, you know, some knowledge of Hebrew, usually a year or two of college level Hebrew. And much like you, you know, I had 4 days of a grueling, intensive interview process. I mean, literally 9 a.m. till 5 p.m., literally grilled from vocation to academic to spiritual to you know, psychological, just to make the decision. After the decision was made, you know, a couple months later, they the college informs and says, you know, welcome to the college community. Once I was admitted to rabbinical school, first year for at least a European program, you are on probation. So they determine whether or not you are viable to enter into and complete the rest of the program. So from day one, we were given a rabbinic mentor. So my favorite story is my rabbinic mentor happened to be the first female rabbi ordained through Great Britain, progressively, so Reform or liberal Judaism. And as I sat there and met with her, and she said, "Let me introduce myself. My name is Rabbi Jackie Tabak." And you know, I said, "No, Jackie, it's okay. I'm well aware. I know who you are." And she kind of gave me this queried look and said, "How do you know?" And I said, "Well, I've read the history books. I'm well aware that you were ordained in 1975." And she stopped me midway through and said, "Don't ever say that again." So I thought, okay, I guess I just made my, you know, rabbinic faux pas number one, even before the program started. And she said, "When you say I've read the history books, do you know how old that makes me feel?" But it was just such an interesting process. So after first year, the board of governors of the college then sit down and discuss each student. And after year one, they then determine whether or not you are viable to complete the rest of the program. After the third year, after we go to Israel, we come back, and then the board then decides, is this person somebody that we can rely upon and call a colleague? And then we finish our training. As I mentioned, I finished my training in New York City on the Upper East Side. I was an intern. And then I was ordained through London and took my first position in upstate New York, which I served proudly, and was just an amazing experience for 6 years. And then I've been down here for about this is now I'm in my fifth year here in the community.
Okay, but you had a whole – you had an interesting life even before, even though being a rabbi was your first gig, so to say, mm-hmm. in this. This is like your one and true call. Mm-hmm. But before this, you weren't just like – little Mr. Good Jewish Boy sitting in the temple studying and knowing everything. And everyone's like, "That guy, he's going to be a rabbi."
No, because I think if you were to ask my parents or even myself when I was 13, 14 years old that, "Oh, this guy's going to be a rabbi," we would have probably laughed in your face. It wasn't in my purview. It wasn't even a thought in my mind. You know, I went through high school, I went through college, and I think it's my second year of college. I studied anthropology and archaeology. I was just fascinated by the entire field. And, you know, when I started, it was 95% female, about 5% male. So I had about 500 students of my colleagues. And after year one, we went from 500 or so that were female and a few male to when I graduated with honors, there were two honors classes. I was the token male out of a sea of women in my anthropology department. And of course, you know, anthropologically, we look at that and say, okay, well, why the trend? What's going on here? And they say, well, you know, we have a lot of men and women that enter into anthropology. And after year one, we realize, what can we do with it? And women tend to actually follow through with their decision. And you know, half my class, three quarters of my class decided to go into economics or philosophy or business. But I stuck it through and was just fascinated by the culture and the society and, you know, looking at it. So, you know, after first year, I took anthropology of Judaism. I took anthropology of religion and kind of looked a little bit deeper. And I fell in love with it. And I did a program out of the Reform movement to which we subscribe to. So we're part of the Union for Reform Judaism, which encompasses around 900 or so odd Reform synagogues in North America under its umbrella term of the World Union of Progressive Judaism, which is housed in Jerusalem, which is about 1,400 congregations worldwide. So as I went to this conference, and I remember sitting there and, you know, interacting with a whole bunch of kids my own age, and it was just an amazing experience. And one of the rabbis said, "Have you ever thought about becoming a rabbi?" And in my mind, I thought, Rabbi, kind of seems like a lot of work, a lot of intent. And in my mind, I had always gone back to my own home synagogue. I grew up in a very, very large synagogue, the largest Reformed synagogue in Canada. We had very impressive rabbis. And in my mind, I kind of had them on that, almost like that pedestal of these are flawless individuals who present themselves in the religion and everything in such a unique and impressive way, and was a little intimidated. And when I finished college, I always knew when I was in college that there had to be something more. I didn't really – I mean, I loved anthropology. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. After studying more about Judaism and just really embracing it, I never wanted the 9-to-5
job. What was the moment you said, I think I'm being called to be a rabbi. This is insane, but I'm going all in.
I think when it was broaching on the second, third year of college, I kind of said to myself, I don't want the 9-to-5 job. I want the job where I'm really able to be present in people's lives, good, joyous occasions, challenging moments, to really be there as a guide and want to be able to really help and make a difference in the world. And I think from that, you know, I kind of said to myself, you know, where can I go with it? I love Judaism. I mean, I'm a proud Jew. I embrace my faith. I love the ability to question and to answer and to really delve deep into our text and to our tradition. You know, deep and personal connection to God, and how can I bring that forward? So it was at that moment, between probably in second and third year, that I started accessing my home synagogue a little bit more and spoke with my senior rabbi at the time. And my senior rabbi was one of the first graduates of the college to which I went to in London. And he had said, you know, there's rabbinical schools in Cincinnati, LA, New York City, but there's also one in Europe, in London. So I thought to myself, you know what? Worst case scenario.
You're in London.
If I hate it, I'll spend 1 year in London. So I kind of did the what we call the Mechina year, the kind of transitional year. And I spent that first year in London to see, do I really want to dedicate my whole life to this? And I loved the program. I was accepted to rabbinical school, kind of like law school a little bit in terms of, you know, kind of in the movies where they say, look to your right, look to your left. You know, half of you will not be here by the end of your term. And I started my program with 13 individuals, and I was ordained with four others. So my class was a class of five. So I'd say 60-65% of my class did not make it through because it is a rigorous program. I mean, it's not only academic, it's spiritual. We have internships. We work in hospices and hospitals. And, you know, we really try and get that whole gambit of, you know, Jewish experience and how we can really make an impact in people's lives.
Okay, so if you weren't a rabbi, what would you be?
So it's a great question. When I was 18 years old, I'm Canadian. So when I was 18 years old, I did a trip once to the Hoover Building at Washington, D.C. to see the FBI. And I was enamored by it. Loved
you
it.
Would want to be an FBI, an agent?
I would want to be an FBI agent. So when I sat there this in the Hoover fantastic. Building and, you know, at the end of their tour, they had said, is there any questions? And, of course, me, the 18-year-old, raises my hand. And I said, can anyone be an FBI agent? And the officer said, oh, absolutely. And I said, wow, this is great. And then he said, oh, but you have to be a U.S. citizen. And my heart sunk. And he said, oh, but don't worry. You have your own called CSIS. And I said, CSIS or the FBI? It doesn't have the same ring to it.
No.
So my brother-in-law, my sister, my wife's brother is an FBI agent out in L.A. So I live vicariously through him.
Oh, so you got – so like God hooked you up. He said, yes. You know, I really want you to be a rabbi. However,
I'm going to give you a brother-in-law
into your life. So does he get to tell you stories? How much can he reveal to you?
Yeah, he can't reveal that much, but he we certainly –
You're a rabbi. The, you can keep it all safe and absolutely. Confidential.
Absolutely. Certain things he can't tell me, but yeah, it's an interesting process.
All right. So, you know, if you got questions for Rabbi Durbin or myself, Father Christian, you can call in here at 772-220-WSTU. Give us a shout, ask us a question, but we're going to head to break. And when we come back, you know, we're going to be talking about what's it like to meet another clergy person. We know what it's like for you sometimes where it can be a little weird and awkward. It's just as weird and awkward for us. And we're going to talk about some of the oddest times when we've interacted with other clergy, whether they're Christian, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Muslim. And that's all coming back. So we'll see you just a sec.
Welcome back, Stuart. We are here, Rabbi Durbin and Father Anderson, at Ask a Rabbi and a Priest Walk Into and Stumble Into a Radio Station. So as we continue, so, you know, Father Anderson, I had kind of gone through what it was like for my personal journey, but I wanted to give enough opportunity for you. What was it like for you going through seminary and how you grew up and where you're from and all that good stuff?
Yeah, I felt always like a curveball, like the weird curveball, or let's say oddball throughout seminary. I first started out when I went, you know, I'm in LA, and when I was in Los Angeles, I'm working as an actor for about 10, 12 years in LA. Before that, I was in Chicago working mainly in theater and some.
Can we IMBD you just to see what you've been in? Anything HBO-ish or
yes, you can IMDb, and there's some work there. And if you ever want to watch The Real when you can't sleep at night and you need something to put you to sleep because it's just going to bore you to tears, yes, okay. It's all out there.
Okay. I'm going to do that right now.
Yeah, go for it. Go IMDb. Check it out. There's no 90210, so I'm going to let you down. Okay, I'm going to let you down. Okay, but you know the one thing I got to tell you:
were you in The OC?
That's a reality show, brother. That's a reality show.
It's all the same.
Speaking of reality, well, I'm going to let everyone know your favorite show. Is it Naked and Afraid?
Well, you know, that's when we look at the context of that show, to be able to go into a unknown, undisclosed area, and to try and fend for yourself. I like the show because it is it speaks to me anthropologically.
Ah, I was looking for the anthropological, yes, the theological reflection. Absolutely. On Absolutely. Naked and Afraid, which you will be posting on your blog starting,
yes,
tomorrow.
Yeah. We can cross post it.
Yeah. What if Naked and Afraid hired you as the resident chaplain, you know, the rabbi, to sit here and coach and work with these young women and men who are just struggling to get through the darkness of life?
I think it would be a neat experience. I'd be the one clothed, but I think it would be a neat experience. But.
Yeah. But helping them get back to the Garden of Eden could, yes, be one of those things, right?
Yes. But we're digressing here. So what was it? What was it like? What was it like for you?
I'll tell you, man. There is a bunch of people in Los Angeles right now. If they found out that I'm a priest, some of them would be like, "Oh, yeah, I get it," and others would be like, "What?" Because I was a doorman, you know, for various nightclubs for a while. I mean, that was before I could really go full time as an actor. Before that, you got to have your side hustle. And mine was, I stumbled into being a nightclub doorman. And the first one out the bat was a friend from high school hooked me up to be like the lead doorman in one of the hottest nightclubs in Los Angeles.
Wow.
So that it became this. And during that time was when I really first started to discern a life in the priesthood, because I was balancing life within the Hollywood world, then being this nightclub doorman, which leads to the parties and all that stuff, and really trying to balance of saying, how can I be a committed Christian, and also discerning this idea of being a priest, while also in the midst of sometimes the hedonistic palaces of L.A. And I remember going to my priest, Marietta Anschutz, she started like the Episcopal School of Los Angeles, and she became a mentor. She's just a fantastic priest, but one who just gives it to you straight. And I remember going into her office after church, because, you know, I'd be at the nightclub till 5 a.m., 6 a.m. working, because it was a after-hours community. And then I would go to her office and be like, I mean, I can't do this. Like, I'm literally, there's parts where I have to judge women and men at the door. I mean, it was that kind of nightclub. Like, what am I doing? This is a joke. Like, I'm a walking paradox. And she was like, all right, so you want to come back here to the church, or you want to get a job in here and you want to preach to the choir? Okay. That's effective for the kingdom. She's like, what better place for the light of Christ to be, but at the front door of a nightclub? She's like, and she didn't judge the nightclub goer. She said, nightclub folks need the light of Christ too. They need that love too. So who are you to say, I'm going to walk away from this because it's so judgmental, and I'm going to go off and just bury myself in a church. So I like that a lot about a lot of my Episcopal brothers and sisters and any kind of clergy, who just like, you got to get out in the world. You got to get your hands dirty, but it's a struggle because the temptation comes. So that is really where I had to kind of, the rubber had to meet the road, where sometimes, sure, I failed. And there's other times where I had just learned how to be unabashedly Christian in the nightclub world and get the courage to speak up and say certain things and be really open about my faith and try to make the best decisions I could. And it led to some of the most unorthodox moments of grace that I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, wow.
You know, just at a party, because I have to be at this after hours community. We're there. you know, look, there's drugs there. There's a lot of stuff going on. And then telling people like, listen, I got to get out of here because I got church in 3 hours. And people are like, you got what? And I remember one person saying to me, like, you know, it's the 21st century, right?
Wow.
And I was like, touche. I was like, yeah. And I laughed. I was like, yeah, but I still go. It's, you know, means a lot to me. It keeps my heart and my mind right. And I feel like I didn't try to proselytize on the person, but that moment to share it with folks who normally wouldn't be talking about church actually led, like at that moment, someone said, so what time is church at?
Hmm.
I said, what's at 9 a.m.? He's like, I'll go with you. I was like,
oh, wow.
Are you serious? Like, yeah, all right. So then my fellow doorman will go to church with me.
Wow.
And then the nightclub itself started asking me if we could hire some of the Jesus people. And I was like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. They're like, you know, the people we go to church with. I was like, oh, why? And they're mm-hmm. like, well, we need people in the nightclub that we can trust.
Yeah.
You know, we got bartenders stealing alcohol. We got guys at the front door who are accepting tips. We need people who are like we can really trust. So I started asking people in my church, other actors who needed a side hustle. And before we knew it, you know, the tenor section of my church choir was helping run the Hedonistic Palace of L.A., you know. And wow. and so the key was, though, in the midst of all that, you got to keep your faith right, because there's many, many moments for you to stumble. I've actually like written this one man show on it. It's not done yet, but of like what that was like, because there was times where I would laugh at myself and be like, no, you're failing.
Hmm.
And there's other times saying, whoa, wait a minute, God was really up to something really amazing here. Like there were some really awesome moments of grace here that helped we nonprofit work we would do, and other people trying to find meaning and purpose and seeking for it. And to be like, hey man, can I talk to you about this? They're never going to go to church, but they found out that the you know, the Jesus guy at the front door does, and they would just want to discuss. So I think that experience helped me be like, there's something I got to really examine here. And I'm on fire when I'm involved and engaged with talking about God and discussing God, and also God in real life, not God tucked away in the church, God in real life. How are you getting your hands dirty with the realities of life and finding Jesus in the midst of all that? And how is Jesus leading through that? And so I started going to when I went through that process I just talked to you about before, fortunately, you know, I had a team of people who approved me to go through it who were outside the box thinkers. Normally they wouldn't have approved someone like me. Mm. They really wanted more. LA, even though it's LA, the Episcopal Church can be a little more traditional in how it's approached to raising up clergy. So with a goofball like me, who was also working in the nightclub, fortunately I had a group of people who said, no, let's take a flyer on this guy and see what happens. So I'm super grateful, because I don't know if I normally would have gone through the process. They would have been, this guy's just too weird.
What was the makeup of your, you know, for seminary in terms of how many other students were in your program in your year? How long was your program?
I started off at a evangelical seminary out in Los Angeles called Fuller. And so that was just a ton of people, but it was amazing because your classrooms are just full of like Methodists and fundamentalists and weird Episcopalians like me. And there were some Catholics and non-denominational folks. And that was all in the same class. We really had to respect one another, because even though we're all saying we love Jesus, there's 89 opinions about this piece of scripture we're about to read in class, and people are going to fight to the death over it. Mm-hmm. But we had to learn how to respect one another and love one another through it and really listen to one another. But then I transferred to Virginia Theological Seminary, which is a purely Episcopal seminary, residential seminary, mm-hmm. smaller, more intimate. So I think my class had like 55 people in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 55,
wow.
60 people, right?
You still keep in touch with any of your colleagues?
Yeah, a good handful of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's people there who they're my go-tos when I have no idea what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I call them and say, what does this chasuble thing mean? Hmm. I mean, I didn't ask that question, but certain mm-hmm. things like that, which, as you know, a lot of it comes back to the temple days. Mm-hmm. So most of the stuff that we do in our liturgy, which is very similar to the Catholic Church, can trace right back to the temple.
So just let me be your go-to.
I should. It would be like, I'll have the OG version of it, not yeah. like some through some Episcopal lens, but no, let's get back to the real, like the tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a tabernacle inside of our church. It. That's getting right. That's not a Catholic thing.
And how long was your seminary training?
Too long. No, it was actually just right. I actually did 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I did 4 years, and I spent some time overseas and worked at a church in Ecuador for a little bit, and that was part of like my internship. Mm-hmm. And really the most formational times were when being a chaplain in a hospital, being in Ecuador and working with folks out there, learning and being formed by them and their incredible faith. The classroom stuff was great. Sure. Back in the States, it was, you know, it's all good, but the stuff where they put you in the field, mm-hmm. and especially being a chaplain, you know, you're in a hospital room with a woman who's just lost her child because she's a crack baby. And now your classroom stuff mm-hmm. doesn't get you through that.
Yeah.
It's God.
Did you, through your training, did you ever have the opportunity to visit the Holy Land?
I did. Mm. I did. I hope to go back and went to the Holy Land, which was great. And, it's something like it's a nice onion that you're going to continually peel back the layers of figuring out what just happened, but it's very powerful. And there was people on the trip who were agnostic who would still say, I don't know what's going on here, but there is something, there's mm-hmm. an energy, there's a powerful spiritual energy that's working through it. But yeah, it was very powerful. It was, I liked how holy places seem to move mm-hmm. sometimes throughout the years.
Yeah.
Getting the whole take on Palestine and Israel and the history there. I mean, you can't dodge that. You mm-hmm. can't just go and be on this spiritual escapade. It's going to get somewhat political. Mm-hmm. There's a social consciousness there. It was powerful. I'm assuming you've been multiple times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, as part of my rabbinic training, we spent my third year of rabbinical school. I was based in Jerusalem. I met my wife as part of my program.
You met your wife in the Holy Land?
Yeah. So my wife at that time was studying her first year of rabbinical school in Jerusalem.
She can't mess this up, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, the challenge was we had a mutual friend in common, and for weeks and months she kept pressing and saying, "I want you to come for Shabbat dinner, Friday night dinner," and I kept dodging the invitation for multiple times. And when it came to our high holidays, which would be Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which happened to be at that time early September, London flew me back to London to go do services for some communities out in Europe. And when I came back, a friend of mine had said, "Look, this is the last invitation. If you come, great. If not, you know, I'm not going to ask you anymore." And said out of love and out of respect and everything else. And I said, "All right, you know what? I'll go." So I went to services at a Reformed synagogue in Jerusalem, and went to a friend's house for dinner. And lo and behold, there was this young woman who was in the program, and we kind of hit it off, and we kind of
smitten right from the jump.
So, you know, some would say what I do remember saying to my wife, we were walking on King George on some of the major street in Jerusalem, and had said to her, "Whoever will marry you." Which will certainly not be me. They'll be a very lucky person. But again, it will not be me. Kind of made that very clear. And what we realized after the end of the year in Jerusalem, we spent about 14 months in Jerusalem. I went back to London. She went back to New York, and we kind of still established this relationship, and kind of talked to the college in New York, and kind of said, you know, what can I do to my final year in New York, which from a European perspective has never happened. They send students third year to Jerusalem. And if you have the language, the culture, and the understanding, and you wanted to do your third year at that time in New York City or LA or Cincinnati, you were able to do so, but you had to have the background. So I spent a long time talking with at that moment, the dean of HUC, Hebrew Union College in New York City, and kind of looking at ways for me to get out. So I had to do a very extensive proposal to my college outlining where I would be interned, where I would do some type of vocational spiritual connection, how I was to write my rabbinic thesis and work with an advisor and kind of work that way. So the college did agree. I did my internship on 75th and Lexington on at Temple Israel in the Upper East Side in Manhattan.
Not a bad place.
So I worked with a rabbi as part of the program. My actual thesis was on Tikkun Olam, which means to repair the world.
Tikkun Olam?
Tikkun Olam.
Not to be confused with the Kuna Matata.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Very
it happens all the time.
Very different.
Happens all the
very
time.
Different.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, and just kind of looking at where it began and where it comes in early rabbinic literature and, you know, where that notion of social justice and social action really fits in, which is more of a 20th century innovation, and how the Reform movement really put that back on the stage and really started imploring the word and its usage. So I kind of looked at it that way. I had an advisor in New York, but I also had my advisor in London who happened to, you know, advise and guide me through the process. My rabbinic thesis is a little bit different, is that we have three independent markers of the thesis. So I have my primary, which is my thesis advisor. It then goes to a secondary advisor to look it over, to make sure it it passes muster, mustard. And then it goes to or mayonnaise.
Put them all three together, like in London.
Absolutely.
They put fries. You saw that. You're in London. Yes. They put fries and mayonnaise.
Well, I'm also Canadian. So, you know, mayonnaise with everything. Put mayonnaise in soups.
I'm won the revolution.
You know, it's look, it's an important savory snack. But, you know, what after it goes to the secondary, then it goes to a independent source. Usually at that time, it was Oxford and Cambridge that would grade the thesis. And all three needed to speak to one another to make sure that it was passable, and luckily in 2008 it was accepted, and it was I was set for ordination. So it was, you know, a very different model, so to speak. So my wife and I came back to New York. I did my final year in New York City. We got engaged. I held off on wedding for at least a year, to my wife's bitter chagrin. She wanted a little bit of a shorter engagement, but I decided at least at that point, let me get through my rabbinic thesis. Let me go through ordination. Let me find that
You're
first
like,
position.
Babe, I got to build this castle first. Then I'm going to invite you into it. Yes. I need to build that castle for you, honey.
Absolutely.
You know, there's some guys who like to bring the woman along.
Absolutely.
But I'm the guy who wants to build the castle and say, come on.
Come on.
Queen.
Absolutely.
All right.
So when I finished, we needed I needed a community that was relatively close enough to New York City. So I was about 3.5-4 hours north of the city. My wife would go down. My wife had 2 more years at that point of rabbinical school, where now she is the right now my wife is the campus rabbi for Hillel, the organization Hillel, at FAU down in Boca.
So do you guys, since you're both rabbis, do you both sit there and get into some deep theological discussions at night, or do when you get home, it's just like putting on Naked and Afraid and 90210 episodes, and that is it, and say, I'm tuning out?
Well, I mean, we also watch The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, or I shouldn't say we, I say my wife does, but
your top three shows right now you're watching.
Top three shows that we're watching. I am a big fan of the Food Network. So we watch a lot of, you know, Master Chef, Top Chef. We watch a lot of those programs.
Kids get into it.
My kids are very big into a show called Nailed It. I don't know if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. Right. So effectively it is, you know, it's a pastry cake show, and they
put nails in the dessert.
No. So it's actually quite cool. They have professional, these just amazing and incredibly well done cakes. And then you have amateurs who have to create the exact same thing, and if they do, then they've nailed it. It's a neat show. My kids are into that, and also, you know, Halloween specials on pastry stuff. Just being able to access that, and you know, they I'm a big fan of the Food Network, or you know, HGTV.
All right, when you have two rabbis in the same household, does it inevitably turn to you guys? Is there a lot of theological discussion? Is there a lot of just shop talk? Is there a lot of, is it you double down on the prayer?
It's actually really neat and really cool to have a spouse that is a rabbi. Cause we do get into, you know, pretty interesting conversations, and because we are individuals and have our own opinions and our own thoughts, we definitely, sometimes are, at odds with one another.
I can see that. You both are some spitfires.
Yeah.
Both of you have some chutzpah to you.
Thank you. I appreciate the
Yiddish.
The Yiddish there.
I worked at a Jewish deli when I was 14, yeah. So I picked up a couple words here and there.
Yeah, and it is interesting to be able to, you know, to whether we are unpacking the Torah portion of the week, or we're looking at, you know, values and ethics, or we're studying Jewish history, you know, just something to be able to give it that different perspective. You know, I will say this is entering into my 11th year. I'm in my 11th year of service. It's really impactful that I have the ability to bounce ideas off her, and she'll definitely give, you know, her thoughts on it, and actually makes me think in a different way sometimes with things that I normally wouldn't think about. So it actually does help. I mean, the hardest part, I will say, is when it comes to high holidays, whether it be Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, I spent weeks, months writing these sermons. And the end, when I feel that, you know, they're good, or great.
She'll tear it up. Yeah.
And say, really, is this what you want to say? Or, you know, have you thought about this? Or, you know, just really, really being very critical, which is wonderful, because it does challenge me. in the part of, well, interesting, I never really thought about that. Or, you know, every year when I first started, every year on the high holidays, one of those moments I dread, not so much the service. I am enamored and love the high holidays. It was just that moment of trepidation of, and now somebody else has to see my
work.
Oh,
yeah.
And she'll look at it, and you know, sometimes it's there have been a few years of tears and frustrations running a little high. But you know, for this year, for example, my wife had said, "This is the first year I didn't yell at you." So it's been a nice process. It's been a nice opportunity to really be able to share that with her, and especially with our family, to be able to, you know, go through what are the major topics that I spoke about this year. I spoke about making choices on Rosh Hashanah, about, you know, choosing Judaism, being proud of being Jewish. You know, there's no apology. Let's not be apologetic about Judaism, which, you know, we can lead into with, you know, next week's discussion, perhaps, of anti-Semitism and discrimination that is prevalent in our society and how we really combat it, or how can we really talk to it.
Yeah.
I also spoke about, you know, making promises. I vowed this year, now I guess it's public that I'm making it on the air, but I promised this year that I would join a gym, and I have joined a gym. I won't tell you which one, so nobody can kind of
I'm changing my gym membership so I can work out with the rabbi.
I appreciate
that's
that.
The next series, working out with the rabbi.
Working out. So I made this promise, and I said to myself, I will actually keep it this year. And then on Yom Kippur, I spoke about, you know, revisioning our history, or looking at the gaps within our history, largely in the guise of what happened with the Holocaust and how millennials in society today are forgetting something that happened 75 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what that implication means for us. And then my Yom Kippur sermon was about mental illness and largely removing the stigma and how we can talk about it.
Well, I could tell you, I mean, I my sermons would be horrendous if it wasn't for my wife, who's just a straight shooter. And I'll tell her the outline that I'm thinking. And it's like she's like swiping left. She's like, nope, nope, no, yes, that's it. Stay right there. Stop talking about everything else. Go with that. And so without my wife, I would be sitting there babbling more of a fool while I'm up there on the pulpit here. So listen, you know, we believe it or not, my brother, we're coming here to a close, and we always want to have some sort of a closing statement here. And we had something prepared, but then after the events of this last week, my brother, it doesn't make sense to go into this other preconceived thought and that we have, but just this reflection on all of our responsibility, especially as Floridians, to be deeply in prayer, but also being extremely generous with whatever organization you want to support our brothers and sisters up in the Panhandle in Georgia. We've all seen it before. We maybe have all experienced it here in Florida. We get it. Now we have our community up north is dealing with it. So I think our final reflection here is be grateful for your AC, be grateful for the food in your fridge, be grateful for the bed that you can sleep in, and also be generous. Pick which organization you want and give. And if you can, when it's right and time, get in the car and go support our brothers and sisters up north after Hurricane Michael.
Absolutely. And as we say in Hebrew, chazak, chazak, v'nit chazek, for those living in the Panhandle and certainly in Panama City, Mexico Beach, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with you. And, you know, if there's any support, we here in South Florida are here for you. And we want to wish you healing and strength during this very challenging and difficult time.
Well, God bless you all. We will see you next week, Friday at 9 a.m. on this AM dial. And we are ready to roll out for next week. We'll talk about a little bit of what it's like to be a clergy person and how does discrimination fit into all that, especially from an anti-Semitic standpoint. All right, we'll see you. This is Rabbi Durbin and Father Anderson, and we are out.